Someone told you knee pain is just getting older? They were wrong. The Joint Relief Institute offers fast joint pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Let's talk a little bit about a new podcast that I happen to listen to, and the person who is the host of it is on our show today. We have with us a powerhouse criminal defense lawyer here in Chicago. She practices all over the nation. She's also a television legal analyst. You've probably seen her on Fox. And she has a new crime podcast. Donna Rotunno is known for defending the indefensible, and especially men accused of sexual assault. She started out as a prosecutor here in the Cook County's state's attorney's office, and she's been in private practice for over two decades. Donna, welcome to the show.
Karen, thank you for having me. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you. So your new podcast, which is called Crime and Justice with Donna Rotunno, it just came out. First of all, tell everyone where they might be able to listen to it.
Well, thank you so much. You can find me on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any place that you get your podcasts. And we just launched it Wednesday of last week. It's going to be every Wednesday and Thursday. We'll be dropping evening time Wednesdays and Thursdays, and I'm just really excited to be able to share my voice in a different way than I have for the last 25 plus years.
It's really, really good. And I will tell you that, I mean, I've been on interviews with you, I've interviewed you, and I've watched you as a legal analyst on television and now your podcast. You have a very good ability to explain the law and technical terms in a way that uses common sense words, and not all lawyers can do that, right? And so I really have to say your podcast breaks it down, and what you're doing when you're asking the questions is really just as brilliant as your commentary. So kudos to you, and I really highly recommend it to people who are interested in true crime. It's really, really good. It's well produced. It's very smoothly done. Tell me what your focus is going to be, and how is it going to be different, say, from other podcasts in true crime?
Sure. So I think the focus is going to be that we are really going to be looking at things that are in the news currently. We're not going to be doing a lot of going back and breaking down cases that have been, you know, litigated through and through. So we're going to be taking cases from the beginning, going through them as they go through the justice system. We'll talk about different aspects of those. So if you tune in, you probably will not be hearing about, you know, like the other day we did Nancy Guthrie, and we did not describe the Nancy Guthrie investigation from beginning to end. We kind of jumped in as to what was happening on that day. So it's going to be, I think, a little bit more topical. Next week, I think we're going to be talking about possibly that Corey Richens trial that's happening. She's the woman who wrote the children's books and then is now charged with killing her husband, and the children's book was about dealing with grief and death, and then later she ends up being the one charged with her husband's death. So we'll be talking about those things as they're happening, and I think that part of it that's different is I'm going to be dealing with these issues really as they would be happening in a courtroom or throughout the investigation. So we're going to look at them the way a trial lawyer would look at these issues and talk about the pitfalls, the positives, and what lawyers should really be doing. So I think it's going to be different in the sense that I'm going to be talking to other legal experts, and we're going to be breaking things down in a way that I think is different than your typical true crime podcast. So I'm really excited to take on this venture. It's definitely a different way for me to talk about these cases and not be the one trying them in the courtroom.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and one of the things, you know, a lot of my listeners are true crime buffs or who are news junkies. And when you watch a story like Nancy Guthrie, you know, I mean, this has riveted everybody. And so you're right. You jump right in. You're not like explaining the dates and what happened and with this day 19. You're talking about what's happening this very minute. You're talking to investigators. You're talking to news people who have their feet on the ground at the crime scene, and you're talking to very experienced lawyers who are, you know, talking about what's next in the investigation and how this evidence will be used. So it's in depth, but it's not outside of the realm of what a layperson is going to understand. In fact, it's the opposite. It's very well explained, and I think it's very, very good. Before we take a break, this is a quick break here, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the Nancy Guthrie case, and you did talk to an investigator, and you talked about certain things. And one of the things you focused on is the issue of the sheriff's office and law enforcement, and some of the comments they're making, which seem to be a little odd. Can you tell us what your view is on some of the things that they've said or that they haven't said that have surprised you?
Sure, absolutely. So anytime an investigation starts when you really have no idea what happened, right? You come upon a house, you know that this 84-year-old woman is missing. And of course, the first thought is not that someone is kidnapped. The first thought is that they wander off. But that doesn't mean that you can't treat it as if it could be something else. And I think what happened here was the sheriff's office was, you know, obviously called out to the house. They were the law enforcement agency that was charged with the task of handling this. And I don't really think they realized how serious this was from the very beginning, which really is amazing to me, given the fact that there was blood on the front step. But nonetheless, I think they made a lot of missteps. And I think a lot of the problems that we're going to see with this investigation moving forward is the fact that they did not secure that crime scene in a way that it should have been secured from minute one. So I think that you're going to have a lot of issues with some of the evidence that maybe they collect from there, given the fact that they did not secure it the way they should have, and the fact that they continue to go back to that crime scene. And then the FBI gets involved, and I thought it was very strange that the sheriff just did not seem to be extremely welcoming to the FBI. And you would think that when you have a case that has literally all the world's eyes on you, that you would want to cross the T's and dot the I's, but they did not do that. And then to make it worse, the sheriff, instead of coming out and giving consistent answers, he doesn't give standard press conferences. He goes around and talks to different media outlets and then gives answers that contradict each other. You know, in the beginning, they told us there was no forced entry into that house, and then they walked that back. In the beginning, they told us that it was the son-in-law who dropped her off, and then he changed it to family members dropped her off. And then it was she didn't show up at church to, no, she hasn't been to church since COVID, and she was going to her friend's house to watch virtual church. So there was just all of this, like, misinformation given, and now he's saying things that in one podcast, you know, or excuse me, one-to-one news outlet, we don't believe she's in Mexico, to maybe she's in Mexico. It's very inconsistent. And what that does is that puts this question about how competent they are to handle this, right? How much integrity does this investigation have if you're not really giving us answers? Now, that being said, law enforcement doesn't have to give us any answers, but if they are going to give them, then they should be consistent. They should be delivered in a way that press can ask questions and the answers are given and there's some continuity. But we have not seen that here, which just, you know, puts the public's trust on high alert.
I totally agree with you. And in this day and age of people who feel like they can help some of these things, especially the people in that area, I mean, if they know that certain facts are true, they might be more likely to come forward with corroborating facts or details that they maybe missed, other people missed, but they now know is relevant because they're getting the right information. And that goes right to the heart of solving this crime. So I agree with you that these messages are not necessary, but if they're going to be put out there, they need to be accurate, they need to be measured, and they need to be planned and executed. So I agree with you on that. Donna, I want to talk a little bit about the Guthrie case and the DNA. And you gave a really nice explanation of the way that these things are tested. Can you tell us what we know about DNA in this case?
Sure. So there are a couple different ways to test DNA. There's the DNA that we are familiar with in terms of what we've heard in cases for the last, you know, couple of decades, where DNA has become, you know, a major point in a lot of criminal prosecutions. And so that DNA is tested in a lab, usually a government lab, and that lab then determines that DNA and what those markers are. And then those markers, they can tell you, you know, whether or not they match to someone. So in your standard case, if you have a suspect, you would take a swab from that suspect, whether it's with a warrant or somebody agrees to submit their DNA, and then you match it with whatever is found, and then you determine if that DNA is a match. If you just have DNA and you're looking for a suspect, they can put that DNA in the CODIS database, and that is in an FBI database that will tell you if that DNA matches a person who has been in the database. So someone who has been charged with a crime, someone whose DNA is in the system for a variety of reasons, and then they will look for a match. That has not happened here. So the suspect is either somebody who has never been part of the criminal justice system in terms of, you know, being having been convicted, or someone who, you know, just has no background. And then it could also mean that it is somebody from Mexico or another country that, whether or not they were convicted, we would not have a record of it. So that's what they've done thus far, and they've not been able to find a match in that way. There are other ways that they can test DNA, which is IgG, which is the genetic genealogy way to test DNA. And what they do there is that they look for specific markers in the DNA. They may be able to narrow it down by eye color or sex or who someone is related to. So now we have these ancestry situations where they can check these databases like they did in Brian Kohberger. So if you remember, on the knife sheath in Kohberger, they found a speck, literally, of DNA, and they were able to match it to his father. And then from his father, they were able to realize that, and when I say match, I mean it had characteristics that matched his father in a ancestry database. And then from that, they got to Brian. So although IgG does not give you a specific person, it will give you characteristics, so then you can narrow down who your field of people that you're looking for, you know, may be.
And what do we know so far about the DNA? And what do you know is being done now to your understanding and knowledge?
So at this point, what I know is that there were no hits in the CODIS system. So the DNA that they did find on the glove, the DNA that they did, and the glove was found about 2 miles from her house, and the DNA that was found in the home, so far there were no hits there. They are now doing that IgG testing, which we were expecting answers on that, you know, either late last week or hopefully early this week. So we will know if they were able to, you know, get any markers. Now, whether they tell us or not, you know, we won't know. But that is where they were in terms of testing that DNA for that genetic genealogy component to then see if they can at least narrow down who they may be looking for. And, you know, again, the DNA isn't dispositive, right? They may be able to narrow it down to people who have been in the house for other reasons. And so, you know, it's a help, but it's not something that's, I think, going to solve the case in and of itself the way it did in Kohberger.
And you've been on television commenting, and you've been had access to some of these people who are on the ground, you know, kind of they know more than the average person. So, again, this is just all speculation, and we are all speculating, and I guess that's what we do sometimes on these cases. I just had a caller, a texter, who says it's a Russian operative. So, and I'm trying to ask him why, and I'm not quite sure. But, you know, everyone's going to have a theory here. You know, kidnapping is just so weird. It's so unusual. We just had a guest talking about the Lindbergh kidnapping back in the 30s, and back then it was kind of like not normal, but it was more common, and this now it just doesn't happen. So do you have a hunch one way or the other about whether or not these ransom notes, the notes that were sent to TMZ, the notes that were sent to the media demanding Bitcoin, do you have any inkling like which way that is? Is it some opportunist who's just jumping on this bandwagon, or is it really the person who abducted who's looking for money?
Yeah, you know, Karen, my feeling on those letters from the very beginning was that they were not tied to whatever happened to her. Could I be wrong? Yes. Am I speculating? Yes. You know, it could it be something totally different? You know, it could be. But I just never thought that this was a true kidnapping ransom situation. Obviously, she was taken, but was she taken for ransom? I just never believed that. And the reason is this. Number one, it took too long for that first letter to come out. It's like, if you really were kidnapping somebody and wanted something in return, especially someone who's ill, especially someone who's older, you would think that you would want to make that transaction as fast as possible, and you would think that the effort and the level of communication would have been more rampant, and there would have been a sign of life. You know, these are things that we look for in kidnapping cases, and you're right, they are very rare, especially in these ransom situations. So I never felt that that was really what this was about. And in some ways, I almost felt like it was a red herring to kind of take law enforcement off the path of whatever actually did happen here. You know, obviously, everyone hopes that she comes back alive, but the more days that go by, I just, you know, logically speaking, that seems less and less likely. And so my feeling has always been that whatever happened in that house, something went wrong. And wherever she is, whether it's a body, whether she's alive, there was some, you know, something happened that made it necessary to conceal her, whether it's her person or her body. And I don't think it was ever really about ransom.
And I think I'm leaning that way more and more now. I have a texter, and this is a good one for you to address, Donna. Karen, why doesn't the Guthrie family demand that the FBI entirely handle the case? What do you say to that?
Yeah, first of all, it's a jurisdictional issue. So, you know, the families can make all the demands that they want, but that doesn't mean that that's what's going to happen. It is up to law enforcement to make that decision. Families do not drive the bus. Once a case is criminal in nature and it's the government that takes care of it, if they were to make an arrest, it is the United States government versus, or the people of the state of Arizona versus, it is not the Guthrie family versus whomever did this. And so, you know, you have to remember that law enforcement makes that decision. And really, what would make this federal is the type of charge this turns out to be. You know, obviously, the federal government can be involved in any investigation they want to be in, especially if it has to do with, you know, taking a body across state lines, whether it has to do with communication via phone, over the phone line. So there's different ways that the kidnapping is a federal offense. So, you know, there are ways that the feds can get their hooks in it. Normally, criminal cases in states are held and happen and taken over by the state authority, whatever that is. Here it happens to be the sheriff. Sometimes it's the whatever city is involved or whatever town. So it's really going to really be determinative in terms of who at least prosecutes it based on what crimes are happening. In terms of taking it over, I think the feds could say, you know, we're gonna be lead on this investigation. But in terms of pushing one jurisdiction out or the other, the family doesn't really have that say.
Yeah, and I really hate to see when you see the battling back and forth. I was reminded of the Gilgo Beach serial killer case, and I've read a lot about that and listened to podcasts. And there was this constant battle between the local police, and there was some corruption going on there. On another note, but then we had the feds coming in and being able to, you know, look into why all these bodies are buried like such a short right. distance away, and yet they were fighting about the jurisdiction rather than thinking about the families of these loved ones. So I think egos sometimes get in the way here in different methods of investigating, you know. And again, you know, you can't really fault some of these local law enforcement, you know, areas. I mean, how many times have they ever dealt with a kidnapping? Probably none, you know.
Right. So they are rare. Yeah, like you said, they are rare. Absolutely.
Yeah, so let's move quickly to our, as you say, our prince, formerly known as a prince and no longer known as a prince, Andrew. He was arrested on Thursday of suspicion of misconduct in office. You talk about this in your podcast a little bit. I've got just literally 45 seconds. What do you know?
Sure. What I know is that he was taken in on suspicions and allegations that he sent information that is confidential to Jeffrey Epstein in emails regarding trade. He was involved in some trade issues. He was appointed to handle issues with regard to England and the royal family in the UK. And he sent emails to Jeffrey Epstein that he shouldn't have. And now there's an investigation pending. He was arrested, not charged. And so we're all waiting to see what happens, but it's very unprecedented. I don't think a member of the royal family has been arrested in hundreds of years. And I think the royal family is probably wishing that Prince Andrew is going far away, because this is a horrible PR for the monarchy that's already been under a lot of attack in recent years.
Totally agree.